Macmillan Audio presents Killing Reagan, The Violent Assault That Changed a Presidency by Bill O'Reilly and Martin Dugard. Read by Robert Petkoff, with an introduction by the author. This book is dedicated to all those who are caring for an elderly person. You are noble. God had a divine purpose in placing this land between two great oceans to be found by those who had a special love of freedom and courage. Ronald Reagan.
Prologue. Reagan Home, Bel Air, California, June 5, 2004, 1:08 p.m. The man with 1 minute to live is no longer confused. Ronald Reagan lapsed into a coma 2 days ago. His wife Nancy sits at the side of the bed, holding the former president's hand. Emotionally and physically exhausted by the ordeal, she quietly sobs as her body rocks in grief. Reagan's breathing has become ragged and inconsistent. After 10 long years of slow descent toward the grave due to Alzheimer's disease, a bout of pneumonia brought on by food particles caught in his lungs has delivered the knockout blow. Nancy knows that her beloved Ronnie's time has come. Counting the former president, 6 people crowd into the bedroom. There is his physician, Dr. Terry Schack, and Laura, the Irish nurse whose soft brogue the president is known to find soothing. 2 of his grown children stand at the bedside. Ron, 46, and Patty, 51, have been holding vigil with their mother for days. They have a reputation for conflict with their parents, but on this day, those quarrels have vanished as they lend their mother emotional support. An adopted son from Reagan's first marriage, Michael, has also been summoned but is caught in Los Angeles traffic and will miss the president's final breath. Outside the single-story 3-bedroom house, the foggy Pacific Marine layer has burned off, replaced by a warm summer sun. The hydrangea and white camellia bushes are in full bloom. A media horde is gathered on St. Cloud Road in Reagan's posh Bel Air neighborhood, waiting with their cameras and news trucks for the inevitable moment when the 40th president of the United States passes away. The former actor and college football player is 93. Even into his 70s, he was so vigorous that he rode the hills of his Santa Barbara ranch on horseback for hours and cleared acres of thick hillside brush all by himself. But years ago, Reagan's mind betrayed him. He slowly lapsed into dementia, so severe that it has been a decade since he appeared in public. The root cause could have been genetic, for his mother was not lucid in her final days. Or it might have been the result of a near-death experience caused by an assassin's bullet 23 years ago. Whatever the reason, Reagan's decline has been dramatic. Over the past 10 years, he has spent most days sleeping or looking out at the sweeping view of Los Angeles from his flagstone veranda. His smile is still warm, but his mind vacant. Eventually, Reagan lost the ability even to recognize family and friends. When his oldest child from his first marriage, Maureen, was dying of melanoma in a Santa Monica hospital in 2001, the former president was in the same hospital being treated for a broken hip, yet was so confused he could not see her. So now, the man who lies at home in a hospital bed clad in comfortable pajamas is a shell of his former self. His blue eyes, the last time he opened them, were dense, the color of chalk. His voice, which once lent itself to great oration, is now silent. Another breath, this one more jagged than the last. Nancy's tears fall onto the bedsheets at the onset of the death rattle. Suddenly, Ronald Reagan opens his eyes. He stares intently at Nancy. They weren't chalky or vague, Patty Davis will later write of her father's eyes. They were clear and blue and full of love. The room hushes. Closing his eyes, Reagan takes his final breath. The former leader of the free world, the man who defeated Soviet communism and ended the Cold War, is dead.
1. Convention Center Music Hall, Cleveland, Ohio, October 28, 1980, 9:30 p.m. The man with 24 years to live steps on stage.
Polite applause washes over Ronald Reagan as he strides to his lectern for the 1980 presidential debate. Footnote: there were supposed to be three debates in the 1980 campaign due to the presence of third-party candidate John Anderson, a Republican congressman from Illinois who ran as an independent. President Carter refused to debate Anderson, giving Reagan and Carter the chance to go head-to-head. End footnote. The former movie star and two-term governor of California is striving to become president of the United States at the relatively advanced age of 69. His jet-black pompadour, which he swears he does not dye, is held in place by a dab of Brill Cream. Reagan's hair was actually brown, but the wet look of his hairstyling made it appear black. His high cheeks are noticeably rosy, as if they have been rouged, although the color may also have come from the glass of wine he had with dinner. At 6'1" and 190 pounds, Reagan stands tall and straight, but his appearance does not intimidate. Rather, he looks to be approachable and kind. The governor's opponent is incumbent President Jimmy Carter. At 5'9" and 155 pounds, the slender Carter has the build of a man who ran cross-country in college. In fact, the president still makes time for 4 miles a day. Carter is a political junkie, immersing himself in every last nuance of a campaign. He has made a huge surge in the polls over the last 2 months. Carter knows that with 1 week until Election Day, the race is almost dead even. The winner of this debate will most likely win the presidency, and if it is Carter, his comeback will be one of the greatest in modern history. One reason Jimmy Carter is behind is that CBS News anchor Walter Cronkite's nightly tally of the number of days the American hostages had been held in Iran helped lower voter confidence in Carter. In another reality, a Carter loss would make him the first president in nearly 50 years to be voted out of office after just one full term. Still boyish at 56, but with a face lined by the rigors of the presidency, he now stands opposite Reagan, a man he loathes. The feeling is mutual. Reagan privately refers to the current president of the United States as a little shit. As President Carter stands behind the pale blue lectern, he makes a sly sideward glance at his opponent. Carter is all business and believes that Ronald Reagan is not his intellectual equal. He has publicly stated that Reagan is untruthful and dangerous and different than me in almost every basic element of commitment and experience and promise to the American people. At his acceptance speech at the August 1980 Democratic National Convention, Carter made it clear that the upcoming election would be a stark choice between two men, two parties, two sharply different pictures of what America is and the world is. The president concluded by adding, "It's a choice between two futures." Indeed, Carter appears to be the smarter man. He graduated 59th in a class of 820 from the U.S. Naval Academy and spent his military career on board nuclear submarines. The Georgia native with the toothy smile possesses an easy command of facts and figures. He has hands-on experience in foreign and domestic policy and often speaks in soothing intellectual soundbites. In 1976, Carter defeated his Republican opponent, Gerald R. Ford, in their three debates, and he is sure he will do the same tonight. Political pollster Pat Cadell, the nation's leading authority on presidential elections and a member of the Carter campaign, predicts that Carter will clinch the election with a decisive debate victory. 2 months ago, Reagan's lead in the polls was 16 points. But if the election were held today, polls indicate Carter would garner 41% of the vote and Reagan 40. However, Cadell has strongly warned Carter against debating Reagan. The biggest knock against Reagan politically is the perception that he is a warmonger. Cadell believes that a debate would allow Reagan to counter those fears by appearing warm and collected rather than half-cocked. Once it became clear that Carter was intent on a public debate, his advisors pressed for the long 90-minute format that will be used tonight, hoping that Reagan will wear down and say something stupid. That would hardly be a first. Ronald Reagan is so prone to saying the wrong thing at the wrong time that his campaign staff has been known to call him Old Foot in the Mouth. Perhaps the worst public gaffe of his career will occur in Brazil. Speaking at a dinner in that nation's capital city of Brasilia, Reagan will hoist his glass, proposing a toast to the people of Bolivia. He immediately attempted to cover the slip by adding, "That's where I'm going," referring to his four-nation swing through South America. In fact, he was not going to Bolivia. His next stop was Colombia, whose capital city is Bogota. Officials tried to cover for Reagan by changing the transcript of the speech to read Bogota. When asked why, they replied that it was what Reagan intended to say and refused to alter their correction. But Reagan is no fool, and is much more incisive than Carter about the Soviet Union's communist regime. He despises it. But he has no foreign policy experience to refer to. Reagan memorizes speeches and phrases rather than immersing himself in heavy study or specific details. While this might not be a problem at most campaign events where Reagan can read from a prepared speech, it could be trouble here in Cleveland. The rules of the debate stipulate that neither candidate is allowed to bring notes to the stage. Yet Reagan will not admit to being at a disadvantage. He believes his communications skills will make up for his lesser book smarts. Reagan, in fact, is far different from how most people perceive him. He has an army of close acquaintances, but few friends. He freely offers his opinions about public policy, but rarely shares deep personal thoughts. Some who work for him think Reagan is distant and lazy, as he so often lets others make tough decisions for him. Others, however, find his manner warm, friendly, and endearing, and his hands-off management style liberating. Reagan does not really care what other people think. He confidently marches ahead, rarely showing any self-doubt. To bring him luck in the debate, Reagan traveled to his native state of Illinois and visited the tomb of Abraham Lincoln this past week. He actually rubbed his nose on the statue of the great political debater, hoping some of Lincoln's brilliance would rub off on him. Not that Reagan is intimidated. Of Carter, he has said condescendingly, "He knows he can't win a debate if it were held in the Rose Garden before an audience of administration officials, with the questions being asked by Jody Powell," referencing the president's hard-living press secretary. The truth is that Reagan's campaign has lost whatever momentum it once possessed. "Ronald Reagan's presidential campaign may be running out of steam," wrote the Wall Street Journal on October 16th. "I think Reagan is slipping everywhere," one of his top aides told reporters in an off-the-record conversation. "If he doesn't do something dramatic, he is going to lose." While this remark is still unclaimed, those within the Reagan and Carter circles believe they were the words of the late Lynn Nofziger, 1924 to 2006, a political veteran who was known for his candor with the press. Meanwhile, Carter's aides are almost giddy in their optimism. "The pieces are in place for us to win," they tell Newsweek magazine. At the stroke of 9:30, the debate begins. Ruth Heinerfeld of the League of Women Voters opens the proceedings with a short speech. She speaks her few careful lines in a hesitant tone before handing the proceedings over to the evening's moderator, veteran journalist Howard K. Smith of ABC News. Smith sits at a desk to the front of the stage, his tie loose and his jacket unbuttoned. "Thank you, Mrs. Heinerfeld," he says before introducing the four journalists who will launch questions at the two candidates. Barbara Walters, ABC News, William Hilliard, Portland, Oregonian, Marvin L. Stone, U.S. News and World Report, and Harry Ellis, Christian Science Monitor. The chatter and applause that filled the room just moments ago have been replaced by palpable nervous tension. There is a sensation that tonight may change the course of U.S. history. As both Reagan and Carter well know, the 1970s have been a brutal time for America. In 1974, President Richard Nixon resigned under threat of impeachment after the Watergate affair. The unchecked growth of the Soviet Union's war machine and the American failure to win the Vietnam War have tilted the global balance of power. At home, inflation, interest rates, and unemployment rates are sky high. Gasoline shortages have led to mile-long lines at the pumps. Worst of all, there is the ongoing humiliation that came about when Iranian radicals stormed the American embassy in Tehran in 1979 and took almost the entire staff hostage. Nearly 6 months later, a rescue attempt failed miserably, resulting in the deaths of 8 American servicemen. 1 week from today, when Americans go to the polls to pick a U.S. president, the 52 hostages will have spent exactly 1 year in captivity. The United States of America is still very much a superpower, but an air of defeat, not hope, now defines its national outlook. The small theater in which the debate will unfold was built shortly after World War I, at a time when America had flexed its muscle on the world stage and first assumed global prominence. But tonight there is a single question on the minds of many watching this debate, 3,000 in the auditorium and 80.6 million watching at home on television. Can America be fixed? Or more to the point, are the best days of the United States of America in the past? Governor, asks panelist Marvin Stone, editor of the magazine U.S. News and World Report, you have been criticized for being all too quick to advocate the use of lots of muscle, military action, to deal with foreign crises. Specifically, what are the differences between the two of you on the uses of American military power? Reagan's career as a Hollywood actor has seen him through a number of personal highs and lows. He has experienced failure and divorce, and endured the humiliation of acting in films that made him look ridiculous. But he has also learned poise under fire and the art of delivering a line. Now, as Stone zeroes in on what some see as a glaring weakness in Reagan's resume, those communication skills desert him. He fumbles for words. Eloquence is replaced by odd pauses. I believe with all my heart, Reagan says slowly, as if he has forgotten the question completely, that our first priority must be world peace. Offstage in the Carter campaign's green room, the president's staff roars with laughter as they watch an uncomfortable Reagan on a television monitor. There is more to Reagan's answer, but it is clear that he is searching for a way to leave the moment behind and revert to the well-rehearsed lines he has prepared for tonight. I'm a father of sons, Reagan finally says, finding a way to use one of those scripted answers. I have a grandson. I don't ever want to see another generation of young Americans bleed their lives into sandy beachheads in the Pacific, or rice paddies and jungles in Asia, or the muddy, bloody battlefields of Europe. About 10 feet away, Carter grips his lectern as if standing at a church pulpit. His eyes are tired and his face pinched. The Reagan campaign argued that the lecterns should be side by side, which would accentuate Reagan's height. The Carter campaign refused. On the night of the debate, as one observer noted, the lecterns were as far as possible apart without actually going off the stage. Naturally peevish, he is tired from staying up late trying to negotiate the release of the American hostages in Iran. The talks are at a delicate point, and he knows that his electoral victory is assured if he succeeds. Carter is so preoccupied with these talks that he initially refused to spend time prepping for the debate. The lack of sleep has made him short-tempered, tense, and difficult to be around. This fatigue also makes it difficult for Carter to hide his utter contempt for Reagan as they share the stage. When it comes his turn to field the same question, the president speaks in simple declarative sentences, reminding the audience and the millions watching on television that he is committed to a strong national defense. He mentions the American journalist H.L. Mencken by name and quotes him on the nature of problem-solving. It is a literary allusion meant to remind the audience of Carter's intellect, but it is a misstep. Mencken is against religion, suspicious of democracy, and elitist. Carter's mentioning him is a thinly veiled attempt to rally the more left-leaning aspects of the Democratic Party. But the American public, Democrat and Republican alike, is in a patriotic mood. They long for a return to simple, straightforward American values. The words of H.L. Mencken only succeed in making Carter look out of touch. Stone pounces. The balding editor leans into his microphone. He speaks to the President of the United States as if he were lecturing a cub reporter. Under what circumstances would you use military forces to deal with, for example, a shutoff of Persian Gulf oil, if that should occur, or to counter Russian expansion beyond Afghanistan into either Iran or Pakistan? I ask this question in view of charges that we are woefully unprepared to project sustained, and I emphasize the word sustained, power in that part of the world. Carter will reach for his water glass 11 times tonight. It is his tell, as gamblers call a nervous tic. Another tell is that Carter blinks constantly when ill at ease. We have made sure that we address this question peacefully, not injecting American military forces into combat, but letting the strength of our nation be felt in a beneficial way, he answers, eyelids fluttering as if he were staring into the sun. This, I believe, has assured that our interests will be protected in the Persian Gulf region, as we've done in the Middle East and throughout the world. This is not an answer. It is an evasion. And while Carter is hoping to appear presidential and above the fray, the fact is that he looks indecisive and somewhat weak. When it comes Reagan's turn to field the same question, he stumbles again, though only for an instant. His thought process seems to be clearing. Reagan has rehearsed this debate with advisor David Stockman, whose sharp intellect rivals that of Carter. That practice now shows in Reagan's new confidence. Statistics suddenly roll off his tongue. He rattles off the 38% reduction in America's military force under the Carter administration, the refusal to build 60 ships that the Navy deems necessary to fulfilling its global mission, and Carter's insistence that programs to build new American bombers, missiles, and submarines be either stalled or halted altogether. The outrage in Reagan's voice will connect to those viewers sick and tired of America's descent into global impotency. Jimmy Carter reaches for his water glass. More than 1,000 miles west, in the city of Evergreen, Colorado, a 25-year-old drifter pays little attention to the debate. Instead, John Hinckley Jr. fixates on schemes to impress Jodie Foster, the young actress who starred opposite Robert De Niro in the 1976 movie Taxi Driver, a film Hinckley has seen more than 15 times. Even though he has never met her, Hinckley considers Jodie the love of his life and is determined to win her hand. Hinckley's obsession with the 18-year-old actress is so complete that he temporarily moved to New Haven, Connecticut to stalk her while she attended Yale University. Hinckley is a college dropout, unable to focus on his own studies, yet he had little problem sitting in on Foster's classes. In New Haven, he slid love notes under the door of her dorm room, found her phone number, and in a brazen move, called Foster and asked her out to dinner. Shocked, she refused. So stunned was Foster by Hinckley's advances and subsequent actions that she will not speak of them for years to come. Now, nearly penniless and having moved back in with his parents, John Hinckley ruminates over how to make Jodie Foster change her mind. His plans are grandiose and bizarre. Hinckley has contemplated killing himself right before Foster's very eyes, or perhaps hijacking an airliner. He has even plotted the assassination of President Jimmy Carter. The pudgy Hinckley, who wears his shaggy hair in bangs, has yet to see a psychiatrist for the schizophrenia that is slowly taking control of his brain. That appointment is still 1 week away, but no amount of therapy will ever stop him from thinking about Jodie Foster and the lengths to which he must go to earn her love. Now, sitting in a small basement bedroom, Hinckley considers suicide. Bottles of prescription pills cover his nightstand. It will take a few more days to summon his courage, but Hinckley will soon reach for the container labeled Valium and gobble a deadly dosage. Once again, John Hinckley will fail. He will wake up nauseated but alive, vowing to find some new way to impress Jodie Foster. Killing himself is not the answer. Clearly, someone else must die. About halfway through the 94-minute debate, Ronald Reagan gets personal. "I talked to a man just briefly there who asked me one simple question," Reagan says gravely. Do I have reason to hope that I can someday take care of my family again? Watching from the side of the stage, Nancy Reagan can see that her husband is gaining confidence with every question. This gives her solace, for Nancy was so afraid that her Ronnie would say something foolish that she initially opposed the debate. More than that of any of his advisors, it is Nancy's opinion that matters most to Reagan. They have been married 28 years, and she has been a driving force behind his run for the presidency. Throughout their marriage, he has chosen to address her as Mommy, a term of endearment mocked by some journalists covering Reagan. Nancy Reagan wears a size 4 dress and has thin legs and thick ankles. Her mother was an actress, her adoptive father an esteemed surgeon, and she grew up determined to find fame. Nancy Reagan was born in New York City on July 6, 1921, as Anne Frances Robbins. Her mother was an actress and her father a used car salesman. The two split up when the girl who had earned the nickname Nancy was just 6. She was sent to live with family in Maryland. Her mother remarried to a Chicago neurosurgeon named Loyal Davis, who adopted Nancy and gave her his surname. In 1949, after working for a time as a sales clerk, she traveled to Hollywood to pursue her dream of becoming an actress. During that time, she dated several prominent names in Hollywood, among them Clark Gable. She relies on sleeping pills and tranquilizers and sometimes bursts into tears from stress, but there is steel in her voice when she corrects her husband or sees to it that one of the campaign staff is disciplined. Nancy Reagan professes shock when the press portrays her as the conniving Lady Macbeth, but the description isn't entirely off the mark. She is by far the more grating half of the Reagan marriage, and she is determined that this election be won at all costs. Cheating is not out of the question. Although he does not yet know it, Jimmy Carter's briefing notes for this debate were recently stolen from the White House and secretly handed over to the Reagan campaign. This, of course, has allowed Reagan to know in advance how Carter will respond to every question. Certainly no one is pointing to Nancy Reagan as having engineered the theft. Indeed, reports of the act will not be leaked to the public for 3 more years, and the real culprit remains in question. Yet it is well known that with so much at stake, she doesn't play nice. To Nancy, gaining access to Carter's playbook is a windfall to the Reagan campaign, not a crime. As noted in Craig Shirley's Rendezvous with Destiny, the late Paul Corbin, an influential Democrat and friend of the Kennedy family who was bitter about Ted Kennedy losing to Jimmy Carter in the 1980 Democratic primary race, admitted to stealing the playbook shortly after copies were assembled in the White House on the night of October 23rd. The book was then given to William Casey, the former World War II OSS spy who led the Reagan campaign. Finally, on October 25th, the Carter book was handed to the 3 key players in Reagan's debate prep, James Baker III, David Gergen, and David Stockman. 3 years later, when word about the theft was leaked, a 10-month congressional and FBI investigation ensued. Corbin never surfaced as the real culprit, and the truth did not come out about his involvement until after his death in 1990. Pat Cadell, when interviewed for this book, said he believes Corbin was given the book by a member of the National Security Council serving in Carter's White House. As the debate continues, Jimmy Carter is not doing himself any favors on stage. I had a discussion with my daughter Amy, Carter says, referring to his 13-year-old, to ask her what the most important issue was. She said she thought nuclear weaponry and the control of nuclear arms. In the green room, Carter's campaign staff is distraught. While prepping for the debate, Carter told them he planned to use his daughter to make a point. His staff strongly urged him not to. In the end, Pat Cadell will later recall, it came down to, I'm the president, fuck you. It is a huge mistake. That the President of the United States is allowing a teenager to decide what matters most to America in a time of such great crisis is laughable. One journalist will later write that the statement was, Carter at his worst, weak and silly. But Jimmy Carter does not have that sense. In the debate itself, it was hard to judge the general demeanor that was projected to the viewers. Carter will write in his diary tonight. He, Reagan, has his memorized tapes. He pushes a button, and they come out. Carter's statement is true. Like all veteran actors, Reagan has mastered the art of memorization. Also, while there are a great number of scripted lines that he has written himself or with his speechwriters to help him score points, Reagan has concocted a simple statement to deride Carter. After the president launches into a detailed and very dry explanation about Reagan's opposition to national health care, Reagan pauses at his lectern. It is obvious that Carter is showing off his intellect in a way that is meant to make Reagan look old, slow, and out of touch. The president's words were specifically chosen to ensure that Reagan's scripted lines could not rescue him, and to make it obvious to one and all that Jimmy Carter is the more intelligent of the two. What follows is Reagan at his best. In four simple words that will be remembered for decades, he succeeds in making President Carter look foolish. They are words that Reagan came up with during the long hours of practice debates, but which he has kept to himself, knowing that for maximum effectiveness, the line must sound completely spontaneous. Slowly shaking his head, Reagan turns to Carter and says, "There you go again." The auditorium erupts in laughter. Reagan's tone is that of a disappointed parent, saddened by a child who has failed to live up to expectations. The words mean nothing and everything. One short sentence captures the mood of a nation that no longer wants detailed policy explanations as to why the economy has collapsed and Americans are being held hostage in a foreign country. The time for words has passed. Now is the time for action. The election may be 7 days away, but for James Earl Jimmy Carter, Jr. of Plains, Georgia, it is over. The only man who does not know that is Carter himself. Both sides felt good about the debate. We'll see whose basic strategy is best when the returns come in next Tuesday, he will write in his diary. Reagan finishes the debate with a flourish. "Are you better off than you were 4 years ago?" he says earnestly into the television camera, wrapping up with an emotional appeal to the American people. "Is it easier for you to go and buy things in the stores than it was 4 years ago? Is there more or less unemployment in the country than there was 4 years ago? Is America as respected throughout the world as it was? Do you feel that our security is as safe, that we're as strong as we were 4 years ago? And if you answer all of those questions yes, why then I think your choice is very obvious as to who you'll vote for." So obvious, in fact, that the election is a landslide. Ronald Reagan receives 489 electoral votes. Jimmy Carter receives just 49. Carter won his home state of Georgia plus Minnesota, the home state of running mate Walter Mondale. The Carter-Mondale ticket also captured Hawaii, Rhode Island, West Virginia, Maryland, and the District of Columbia. On January 20, 1981, Ronald Reagan is sworn in as the 40th President of the United States. John Hinckley, Jr. has a new target. 2. Universal Studios, Hollywood, California, September 1950. Daytime. The chimpanzee wears a white jumpsuit as she climbs high into the branches of a eucalyptus tree in the front yard of 712 Colonial Street. Not an actual street, but a movie set at Universal Studios. Similar homes on the back lot would be used for many productions in the years to come, including the hit television series Desperate Housewives. Peggy is 5 years old. She was born in the jungles of Liberia and lured into captivity with a bundle of bananas. Since coming to Hollywood, Peggy has been taught to understand 502 voice commands, ride a tricycle, do backflips on cue, and put on a necktie. She has become one of the motion picture industry's top animal performers, commanding $1,000 per week in salary. Now, as the cameras roll, she is starring in her first title role. The film is a screwball comedy entitled Bedtime for Bonzo. Action! Cries director Fred De Cordova. Fred De Cordova, a graduate of Harvard Law School, will go on to become Johnny Carson's longtime producer on The Tonight Show. In that time, Carson will make several comedic jabs at bedtime for Bonzo. Peggy instantly obeys trainer Henry Craig's instruction to do what comes naturally for her. Climb a tree. One would think the act will not be quite as easy for her co-star. 39-year-old Ronald Reagan balances precariously on the top step of an 8-foot ladder leaning against the tree trunk. In his slick-soled shoes, dress shirt, and tie, he is hardly dressed for climbing. His trademark pompadour, meantime, is carefully brill-creamed into place. There is no safety rope to halt his fall should Reagan lose his balance, but that is not a problem. Nearly 20 years after his college football career ended, the rugged actor is still lean and athletic. Reagan pulls himself up into the tree with ease, with not so much as a hair out of place. Just a few years earlier, it would have been ludicrous to imagine Ronald Reagan acting opposite a chimpanzee. He was a star contract player for the Warner Brothers film studio, well on his way to becoming the sort of lead actor who could command any role he wished, like his friends Cary Grant and Errol Flynn. In every way, Ronald Reagan's life in the early 1940s could not have been better. But that was then. Ronald Reagan is 26 when he steps off the electric trolley at the Republic Pictures stop in Hollywood. The year is 1937. A torrential April rain drenches the young baseball announcer as he strides quickly along Radford Avenue to the studio gate. If Reagan were to lift his head, he would see the legendary Hollywoodland sign just miles above him in the hills, but he keeps his head low, the collar of his raincoat cinched tightly around his throat. Dutch, as Reagan is known to family and friends, works for radio station WHO in Des Moines, Iowa, covering sports. He has come west to visit the Chicago Cubs training camp on nearby Catalina Island, 20 miles off the California coast. The Wrigley family, who owned the Cubs at the time, also owned a controlling interest in the island, which is why the Cubs trained there. But the storm has shut down the ferries and seaplane service to Catalina, giving Reagan a free day in Los Angeles. Cowboy singing sensation Gene Autry is filming a new western called Rootin' Tootin' Rhythm, and a few of Reagan's friends from back home are playing the roles of singing cowhands. They were members of a band called the Oklahoma Outlaws, which had a big following in the Midwest. Autry, who was looking for ways to broaden his national audience, had arranged to bring them to Hollywood. Reagan, who has long fantasized about being a movie star, has come to offer moral support to his pals. Reagan will later write that hundreds of young people from Iowa, Illinois, and just about every other state shared his fantasy. They stepped off a train at Union Station in Los Angeles. They got no closer to realizing it than a studio front gate. But thanks to his pals, Reagan makes it through the gate and hustles to Autry's soundstage. He enters the cavernous building with Klieg lights hanging from high wooden beams. He is immediately intoxicated by the sight of the actors, cameras, lights, and everything else that goes into making a movie. All is quiet as filming begins. Gene Autry himself, dressed in the knee-high boots and gun belt of a cowboy, strums a guitar and sings a lament about life on the prairie. The set is made to look like the parlor of an ornate home. Autry is surrounded by musicians and actors clutching fiddles and guitars, all dressed as cowboys. "Cut!" yells director Mack Wright as the song winds down. Autry stops. Everyone relaxes on the set. A few minutes later, as Wright calls for action, the scene is repeated. "I was starry-eyed," Reagan admits to a friend that night. His friend's name is Joy Hodges, and she and her band are performing at the stately Biltmore Hotel in downtown L.A. Joy knew Reagan back in Des Moines, and they now enjoy a quiet dinner between sets. The walls are lined with oak, and a marble fountain gurgles in the background. Reagan tells her his dreams of becoming a movie star and how he wishes he could find a way to break into the business. Joy Hodges, a pretty, raven-haired lady, finds Reagan intriguing. Take off your glasses, she commands. He removes them, and Joy instantly becomes a blur to Reagan. Hodges, on the other hand, can see him quite clearly, and she likes what she sees. Studios don't make passes at actors who wear glasses, she warns him, before going back on stage for her second set. Thus, the fairy tale begins. By 10 the next morning, Reagan is meeting with Joy's agent, who arranges a screen test for the handsome young man. The test eventually makes its way to Jack Warner, the powerful head of Warner Brothers Pictures. He also likes what he sees, and offers Reagan a 7-year contract at $200 a week, almost 3 times what he makes at WHO. A hairstylist transforms Reagan's center-parted look into the trademark pompadour he will wear the rest of his life. A tailor ingeniously alters the taper of his collar to create the optical illusion that Reagan's neck is not so thick. Finally, after some deliberation, the publicity department declares that he can keep his real name on screen. So it is that by June 1937, just 2 months after stepping out of the rain at Republic Pictures, Ronald Reagan is acting in his first motion picture. The movie is called Love is on the Air. Appropriately enough, Reagan plays a radio announcer. Sarah Jane Mayfield, or Jane Wyman, as she is known in Hollywood, knows a thing or two about love. It is early in 1938 as she arrives on the set of the film Brother Rat. At the age of 21, she is already married. Her current husband is dress manufacturer Myron Futterman, whom she wed in New Orleans 6 months ago. Small, with bangs worn high on her forehead and a husky voice that will one day become her trademark, Wyman has struggled to break into Hollywood since coming west from Missouri. But now she finally has gotten her foot in the door through a series of small roles in B-movies and is determined to become a star. Her weakness is being impulsive when it comes to love, and she separates from Futterman almost as quickly as she married him. As Ronald Reagan begins his 10th film in less than a year, there is no hiding the fact that his Brother Rat co-star has quickly become infatuated with him. By December of 1938, Jane Wyman officially divorces Myron Futterman and takes up with Reagan. They soon become Hollywood's golden couple. Wholesome and happy and utterly completely American, in the words of gossip columnist Luella Parsons, who, knowing that nothing in Hollywood lasts forever, nevertheless predicts that their union will last 30 years. Wyman and Reagan are married in January 1940, shortly before Reagan begins filming Newt Rockne All-American with Pat O'Brien. He plays the role of legendary Notre Dame running back George Gipp, uttering the immortal line, "Ask 'em to go in there with all they've got, win just one for the Gipper," before dying on screen. It is his first A film, and is soon followed by a co-starring role alongside the swashbuckling womanizer Errol Flynn in Santa Fe Trail. Just 4 short years after breaking into Hollywood, Ronald Reagan is now a major star. He and Wyman are soon building a massive new house and spending their evenings at the best Hollywood nightclubs. In 1941, Wyman gives birth to a beautiful daughter whom they name Maureen. World War II is raging, but Ronald Reagan's poor eyesight exempts him from fighting overseas. He stays in California, but is eager to contribute to the war effort. Long before moving to Los Angeles, Reagan had joined Iowa's Army Reserve, serving in the cavalry. In May 1937, before making his first motion picture, he was offered a commission as a second lieutenant in the U.S. Cavalry Officer Reserve Corps. He begins active duty as a second lieutenant in the U.S. Army in April of 1942, assigned to making training films and selling war bonds. He secures a top-secret clearance, meaning he is often privy to classified information about upcoming American bombing raids. In the process, he learns how such attacks are planned and conducted. Reagan's career up until now has seen him in a series of jobs that do not require leadership or organization. But the Army teaches him about taking charge and motivating the men he commands. These are lessons he will use for the rest of his life. The duties of Reagan's U.S. Army 1st Motion Picture Unit shift in the waning days of the war. In June 1945, he sends a photographer to a local aircraft factory to take pictures of women working in war production. Private David Conover shoots using color film, a rarity at the time, snapping the indelible image of an 18-year-old brunette holding a small propeller. The wife of a young merchant seaman, the fetching girl earns $20 a week inspecting parachutes at a company named Radio Plane, which also makes some of the world's first drone aircraft. She has a wholesome smile, wears a modest green blouse, and has clipped her factory ID badge to the waistband of her pleated gray skirt. Her name is Norma Jean Daugherty, and these photographs will soon open the doors of Hollywood to her. Eventually, Norma Jean will divorce her sailor husband and change her name, as she becomes one of the most famous women in the world. As his own career is on the verge of combusting, Ronald Reagan is directly responsible for initiating the fame of Marilyn Monroe. At war's end, Reagan makes a triumphant return to Hollywood. Warner Brothers gives him a new long-term contract worth $1 million with a guarantee of $52,000 per movie. Reagan and the petite Wyman live in a 5,000-square-foot custom home on a knoll overlooking Los Angeles. He spends his off time playing golf with comedians Jack Benny and George Burns and enjoys steak dinners with Wyman at the exclusive Beverly Club. Also in 1945, Reagan and Jane Wyman adopt a baby boy, whom they name Michael. Reagan's first movie of the new contract is Stallion Road, in which he plays a horseback-riding veterinarian. Reagan's on-screen mount is a midnight black thoroughbred mare named Tar Baby. Reagan likes Baby so much that he buys her before filming is completed. To give her a place to gallop, he fulfills a lifelong dream and buys a small ranch in the San Fernando Valley, which he will keep for a couple of years before buying a larger property in Malibu. Then, tragedy strikes. In June of 1947, Jane Wyman gives birth prematurely to a young daughter. Reagan is ill in the hospital with pneumonia at the time and cannot be at Wyman's side when Christine Reagan comes into the world. She lives just 9 hours. The loss deeply affects his marriage to Wyman. Michael Reagan later wrote of Wyman that the death of Christine was probably the most painful experience of her life, and I don't think she ever truly recovered from it. Wyman's 1951 movie The Blue Veil reopened those wounds as the protagonist dealt with the matter of premature infant death. Filmed in and around St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City, the film had a profound impact on Jane Wyman's life. The experience brought about a spiritual transformation. 3 years later, Wyman was baptized into the Catholic Church. Trying to put their lives back together, Ronald Reagan and Jane Wyman pour themselves into their work. Yet, despite all the trappings of success, Ronald Reagan's glory days in Hollywood are numbered. Warner Brothers soon casts him in a series of forgettable pictures that make little money and are scorned by critics. Reagan is perplexed. His Hollywood fairy tale is in danger of coming to an end, and he is powerless to do anything about it. Reagan is a hard-working, restless man who craves physical activity. He is the son of an all-too-often drunk Irish shoe salesman and a Bible-thumping mother. Their parenting methods taught young Ron to avoid extremes in behavior, leading him at times to appear clueless and shut off. Also, it is true, Ronald Reagan is not a great intellect, having struggled to maintain a C average in college. Yet he can memorize paragraphs of script with ease and then recite them again and again on cue. Reagan also is a thinker, craving long periods of solitary meditation, preferably on horseback. He believes that, as you rock along a trail to the sound of the hooves and the squeak of the leather, with the sun on your head and the smell of the horse and the saddle and trees around you, things just begin to straighten themselves out. Reagan first learned to ride while working as a teenage lifeguard back at Lowell Park in Dixon, Illinois, and lives by the saying, "Nothing is so good for the inside of a man as the outside of a horse." But no long gallop aboard Baby can hide the fact that Ronald Reagan's personal and professional lives are now veering in new and disastrous directions. Jane Wyman is growing bored with her husband, though he is oblivious to her dissatisfaction. Reagan can often be self-centered and callous. He has a habit of talking down to his wife because he possesses a college degree and she does not. He also likes to be the center of attention, sometimes screening his personal print of the 1942 movie King's Row when guests come over for dinner. Of the 53 films he made in his career, King's Row was Reagan's favorite. He plays the second lead in the picture, a young man whose legs have been amputated by a villainous surgeon. Reagan's key line, which he uttered spontaneously, happens the moment the young man looks down and sees that his legs are gone. "Where's the rest of me?" It later became the title of his 1965 memoir. Jane Wyman is not impressed when friends suggest that Reagan, who was developing a fondness for political activism, run for Congress. "He's very politically minded. I'm not very bright," she answers coolly when asked if she supports the idea. Ronald Reagan has also become fond of lecturing. Any topic will do. "Don't ask Ronnie what time it is," Wyman warns fellow actress June Allison, "because he will tell you how a watch is made." When a baseball game comes on the radio, Reagan often ignores his wife and children, turning up the volume and drowning out their words by pretending to be the broadcaster and calling the game. In that way, he shuts out his family for hours. To make matters worse, Reagan resents Wyman's growing level of celebrity. Her movies, such as The Yearling, are earning money, critical praise, and Academy Award nominations. No longer the star when the two go out, Reagan must hover at his wife's elbow as she basks in the public's applause. So it is that Ronald Reagan's newfound political activism, his wife's growing fame, and the death of their baby daughter combine to drive a wedge into their marriage. In 1947, Wyman cruelly mocks him during a lengthy speech he delivers before the Screen Actors Guild membership, foreshadowing the marital split that is soon to come. "Oh, for God's sake, Ronnie," she shouts to actress Rosemary DeCamp. "Shut up and go shit in your hat." The end comes while Wyman is filming Johnny Belinda on location in Pebble Beach, California. She begins an affair with co-star Lou Ayres. In May 1948, Jane Wyman files for divorce from Ronald Reagan, citing mental cruelty. "I just couldn't stand to watch that damn King's Row one more time," she explains when the marriage is finally over. The divorce traumatizes Reagan. He is shattered and sometimes weeps openly, telling friends that the end of his marriage has left him ashamed. He clings to hope that the relationship can one day be salvaged and still drives the green Cadillac convertible Wyman gave him as a gift before the divorce. But when she publicly declares, "Lou Ayres is the love of my life," it becomes clear that there will be no reconciliation. Embittered, Reagan begins to behave in a callow fashion. He spends lavishly at Hollywood nightclubs such as Ciro's, the Coconut Grove, and Slapsy Maxie's, drinking too much and conducting a series of sexual affairs with women decades younger than he. His actions do not go unnoticed by the press. Silver Screen magazine writes, "Never thought we'd come right out and call Ronnie Reagan a wolf, but leave us face it, suddenly every glamour gal considers him a super sexy escort for the evening. Even he admits he's missed a lot of fun and frolic and is out to make up for it." One of Reagan's liaisons is with actress Penny Edwards, who is just 20, and another is with the 22-year-old actress Patricia Neal. During a memorable one-night stand in his apartment, Reagan takes the virginity of 18-year-old Piper Laurie after first barbecuing her a hamburger. Ironically, at the time of their liaison, Reagan was playing the role of Laurie's father in Louisa. The actress will later remember Reagan as a show-off in the bedroom, a self-absorbed lover who bragged about his sexual stamina during the act and became impatient when she did not climax. "You should have had many orgasms by now," Reagan scolded Lori after what she claims was about 40 minutes of sex. "You've got to see a doctor about your abnormality." Lori would go on to win Academy Award nominations for The Hustler, Carrie, and Children of a Lesser God. Patricia Neal would win an Academy Award for Best Actress in 1963 for Hud, co-starring Paul Newman. Penny Edwards was never nominated, but made a name for herself as Roy Rogers' love interest in six Hollywood westerns. Reagan reaches bottom when he wakes up one morning at the Garden of Allah Hotel on Sunset Boulevard and does not know the name of the woman lying next to him. After that, he vows to rein in his behavior. But he does not. 3 years after his divorce, when he proposes marriage to 26-year-old actress Christine Larson by offering her a diamond wristwatch, Reagan is also having relationships with six other women. Larson turns him down. Now living on his own in an apartment above the Sunset Strip, Ronald Reagan soon grows apart from his young son and daughter. 3-year-old Michael and 7-year-old Maureen Reagan will long remember their father as loving but also absent from their lives for long periods of time, as was their mother. Both children are sent away to boarding schools by the time they enter the second grade. There's a distinct difference between the care provided by a parent and the care provided by a paid caretaker, Maureen will say years later. It was simply one of the prices all of us had to pay for their success. During this playboy period, Reagan's success has flatlined. He is no longer viewed as a bankable star by Hollywood standards. To add insult to injury, as his movie career is clearly in its death throes, Wyman wins her first Academy Award and arrives at the ceremony with Lou Ayres as her date, which only makes Reagan's career seem more marginal. Wyman won Best Actress for Johnny Belinda in 1949. She was also nominated for Best Actress in 1947, The Yearling, 1952, The Blue Veil, and 1955, Magnificent Obsession. By 1949, Warner Brothers terminates his long-term contract, leaving him without income to pay the bills for the high-flying Hollywood lifestyle to which he has grown accustomed. Desperate, Reagan accepts the offer to work on Bedtime for Bonzo. Animal movies are all the rage in Hollywood in 1950, thanks to the success of the February release Francis the Talking Mule. Jimmy Stewart has just finished Harvey, about a man and his invisible rabbit companion on a set just one block down from where Reagan now films Bonzo. Harvey will open in October and earn Stewart his fourth Academy Award nomination. As Ronald Reagan now clambers up into the tree after the chimp Peggy, Bonzo, he still believes his career will rebound. The film's other star, Diana Lynn, awaits him in the branches, adding to the comedy's madcap narrative. Meanwhile, Bonzo has jumped off a branch and is now inside the house, somehow managing to call the police. Soon there will be cop cars and fire trucks screaming down Colonial Street, all in a scripted attempt to get everyone down from the tree. This is a far cry from Reagan's days making movies such as Dark Victory with major stars such as Humphrey Bogart and Bette Davis, or Santa Fe Trail with Errol Flynn. In that movie, Reagan played General George Armstrong Custer, whom he considers a great American hero. Still, Reagan is a professional. He shows up each morning on time, knows his lines, and is pleasant to his co-workers. There are times, however, when he seems distracted, for there are pressing concerns on his mind. Ronald Reagan is nearly 40 years old. His profession is acting, but politics has set a new fire burning in his belly. The newspapers are full of the amazing events going on in the global fight against communism as President Harry Truman sends U.S. troops into Korea to stop the communist advance. Reagan is an ardent supporter of the Democratic president and campaigned for him in 1948. With Truman's time in office due to end if he doesn't run for re-election, Reagan is hoping former Army General and World War II hero Dwight Eisenhower will run for president as a Democrat. Even as he deals with Peggy the Chimp, Reagan is planning an article for Fortnite magazine in which he will explain how to fight communism worldwide. His determination to end the communist threat is steadfast. The real fight with this totalitarianism belongs properly to the forces of liberal democracy, just as did the battle with Hitler's totalitarianism. There really is no difference except in the cast of characters, Reagan will write. But that is a few months off. For now, Reagan is engaged in far less intellectual fare. Cut! Director Fred DeCordova yells. Ronald Reagan climbs down from the tree.